So I thought we'd talk a little bit today about what's been happening to your readers. You all know the statistics about newspaper readership in certain key categories declining, declining, declining. But why? It isn't like those people aren't reading anymore. So let's talk about the reading experience that they're looking for, the kind of media experiences they have, and we might be able to draw some conclusions about some creative things you might think of doing interactively. We just want to have a couple of goals in the next 40 minutes or so. Look quickly at some of the trends in media usage patterns that you've been talking about, and look at the impact on reading preferences, and then think a little bit about what is it that readers want. Disruptive change. What an incredibly disruptive time we're living through. This is the biggest thing to hit mass communications in my lifetime. Probably the previous thing of this kind of phase change scale was network television. But in many ways, network television wasn't that different than newspapers or print. It's linear. You produce it, you put it out there. The internet is different. So we've talked about, this is just one of the research studies, one way to express what's happened with younger readers. Half of all of the 18 to 22s were reading daily newspapers regularly in 1972, and less than a quarter are today. And what we've found at the Readership Institute at the Medill Media Management Center, we've done a lot of research on this. Some of you probably know of Hazel Reinhart, who's a really top demographer. And she's done a lot of generations research, and I know that you've heard about generations this morning. Basically, what her research tells us is that generation by generation, people are reading less print. If they haven't got the newspaper habit by the time they're 25 or 26, they probably never will. I mean, I grew up as a little kid, like probably everybody else in this room, you know, hanging upside down from my grandfather's lap, reading the outside while he was reading the inside of the paper, and reading it with my dad, and watching my dad read that strange thing called the Wall Street Journal, and seemed to have so many words and no pictures. But not all kids did grow up with that sort of cozy feeling about newspapers. An editor of one of the top night reader newspapers said that to me the other day, and I thought it was an amazing quote. She said, "Our company disappeared like it was just another dot-com." And I'm not here to give you bad news, but something to think about is they were very profitable when that happened. What that tells us is that profits can't stave off the changes we're seeing. So we want to do everything we can to learn about the nature of this change and how we can take advantage of it and profit from it. You remember back in the 60s, about maybe three-quarters of the room, people in this room can remember back that far. Print news editors always put down television. As late as the late 80s, when I was writing a press column for Time magazine, there was always a feeling if the story was about TV news, it was about TV news being bad. I mean, there was kind of an assumption that you would say TV news was bad if you wrote about it. But that didn't stop TV from becoming so dominant. In the 90s, print editors disdained the internet. It was in 1994 that I jumped over the fence from print and Time magazine to, I was actually the first Time Warner New Media employee, because I thought if you were going to do it at all, you should do it all the full time, because it was just too complicated and too big. And that's actually was my first reaction when one of my colleagues said, we should put the magazine online. And my first reaction was, what's in it for us? Because at that time, we didn't even have browsers. At that time, the internet was still black and white. And it was just text with a little blinking cursor. A lot of you probably remember if you saw the internet at that time. Why would we do that? We put so much work into making this beautiful publication. And then we put it out there in this limited form. I very quickly changed my mind when I started, as soon as I saw a browser. We were literally jumping up and down that day at the magazine when we saw Mosaic for the first time, which was, as you know, invented out here. So here's a quote from a Harvard Business Review article I was reading. Newspaper editor to online editor requesting information. Get the hell out of here. I've got a real newspaper to put out. Now I'll give you a parallel quote from my own experience with the number two editor of Time magazine at the time. I don't see why we should ever give them a goddamn thing. He didn't think of the online site as being part of the magazine. He just thought of it as being an annoyance. He's changed his mind, by the way. But I was one of those people who had to kind of keep selling, sell, convince. So the danger when we first went online in a big way was that we would do what companies and industries often do at a time of disruptive change. And one way to put it is pouring new wine into old bottles. In other words, You're reacting to something new by trying to make it look like the old. So there are a lot of examples that have been documented by people at Harvard and elsewhere. You remember what happened with Kodak and digital photography? Kodak finally realized it couldn't hold the film business. The film business couldn't hold off digital. So it jumped into digital with major investments, but a lot of them were in the wrong things and in the wrong directions and the wrong price points. And this article, which is referenced here, Disruptive Change When Trying Harder is Part of the Problem, has a lot of detail on that. So one of the dangers that we face at a time like this, you're all trying to think, how can I make my smartest investment in new media? What's the best thing for me to do? This is real money I'm talking about here. And what you don't want to do is jump in the wrong direction and waste your money. Similar thing happened with R.H. Donnelly, the printer here in Chicago. It's funny, when I was first a reporter at Time in the early years, I used to be one of the kids who would be given the new cover when it changed on Friday night, would fly out to Chicago with it, to Donnelly. Because we used that in those pre-digital days, we still had to bring the transparency to the printing plant. Donnelly realized digital publishing would be great for books, and they jumped in the wrong direction. And one of the problems that they had was that their existing clients didn't understand why it was a good idea. So they tried to start a digital publishing effort early on, and it failed. Not because it wasn't a good thing to do, but because I guess the market wasn't ready for it. Well, I think the market is ready for this stuff now. Now, if you look, excuse my math symbols here, but in 1997, the newspaper industry, according to the Harvard Business Review, was investing less than $5 million in online news and information. And by 3 years later, it was more than $700 million. Time Warner, in 1998, decided to take a look at all these little internet operations all over this huge company and find out if it was time to think of it as a serious business. And they found out they had 50 online operations, and their total revenue was $40 million a year. They said, oh, I guess we're in business. So at that time, they started assigning real ad salespeople to the websites and things like that, and trying to figure out, as you know, less than 2 years later, they bought an internet solution by merging with AOL. They couldn't figure out how to do it in time, and they were worried. It was coming on so fast. The company had no idea. And the reason they had no idea is because they didn't have separate P&Ls for those new media operations. They were all sort of being run out of, you know, whatever magazine or other operation they were associated with. So where did all these readers go that we're talking about? You know, the guy in Watergate said, follow the money. Well, I'm always saying follow the readers. What are they doing? And that's what I want to talk to you about today. This is from a recent report you've probably heard about. If not, I can give you the reference for it. It's called Abandoning the News, written by Merrill Brown for the Carnegie Reporter. Merrill Brown is the program officer, I guess that's what he's called, for Carnegie Foundation. And what this big long sentence basically says is, it's not going to be the way it was before. Things are changing, and they're not going back. So here's one place they went, immersive media. You know, if you're listening, if you have like a cheap pair of earphones, and you can kind of hear the left ear and the right ear and everything else in the world, but if you have a really good pair of earphones, you feel like the music is inside your head. It's not coming from a particular direction. It's immersive. That's immersive sound. If you walk into a really good concert hall, and it has really good acoustics, you walk in and the music is just, you're walking into the music. You don't feel like it's coming from the stage or the left or the right or up or down. It's just immersive. Well, immersive media are coming on really, really fast. And this is one of the things that I want to show you some examples of how it's being used in news. Gaming. Rupert Murdoch recently made a speech that you're probably aware of where he used a really interesting phrase. He said that he was a digital immigrant, and that most of the people he knew in the news business were, but that their children were digital natives. And so it was like trying to learn a new language, but they had to learn how to communicate with the people in this new digital country. So what are the organizational characteristics of a news operation? Because this is part of what we need to understand if we're going to adjust to this kind of radical change. The research establishing what I'm about to show you comes from the Media Management Center, but the slide is courtesy of Nora Paul, who directs the Institute for New Media Studies up at the University of Minnesota. Okay, so here's the newsroom. Does anybody know what type of organization and newsroom culture is most closely resembles? Hospitals and military. There was actually a pretty substantial research project that at the Media Management Center that established this. And what it means is that all three cultures are rapid response organizations people who know exactly what to do when, in case of news, when news breaks, you know what to do, you just do it. Well, there's a reason why people in the news business do things the way they do them. You know, these modes of operation have been developed over a long period of time. They're the best way they know to respond to constantly changing news. Similar for medicine and actually, I wouldn't want the medicine people to get too creative, you know. Just go ahead, do what you know. But in the face of that, here we are with this fairly rigid, very sophisticated, highly developed, rapid response culture. That's what a newsroom is. And you have to understand this new language that Murdoch was talking about. We understand things like cut lines, bylines, headlines. But what are multimedia stories? What is that? What do we mean by interactive news? I mean, news is news. You don't want somebody messing with it. What does that mean? What is nonlinear storytelling? I mean, I could give you the basic explanations for these things that we've all been giving students for years. But this is, what's mutable news? It's news that you can publish and then go online 5 minutes later and update, as opposed to publishing in print. So what we're doing basically is we're saying farewell to the one-way news world. News that came at predictable times. Walter Cronkite gave you the news, you watched the news on television, the sportscasters told you what was going on in the game. Papers came out in the morning or the afternoon, news was on at night. And now it's on all the time. So say hello to the gamers. This is what I want to help you understand today, what's going on with those two generations that we talked about that are not reading the newspapers often enough. They're looking for an immersive experience. They're looking for control. The thing about games, and it sounds like almost everybody in here has played video games at least once, is that you're the only actor in this drama, and everybody else, I mean, you're the real thinking actor, and you're the only one who can change the plot. Everybody else in the game responds to your actions. And it's very easy to get rewards. Kill somebody, get some more armor or something, or whatever kind of game it is. There's this irregular system of rewards. And you can change the story, and you can personalize your path. Interestingly enough, here are these things that we're talking about, customization, personalization. We've been talking about them for 2 days now with community and things like that. A lot of those ideas probably come from gaming. They didn't just arrive with the internet. And the reason that I want to repeat that is because that's your reader. Your reader is looking for interactivity, looking to do something with the content. In 1996, computer and video game sales were $3.7 billion, pretty big. I remember Time Magazine was doing a cover about then, about how huge that was. Well, they've doubled since then. More than doubled. By 2004, they were up to $7.3 billion. I thought this was a typo when I put it in, because the numbers are reversed, but actually those are the real numbers. So you've heard this, right? That people are spending more on video games now than they are on movie box office, and they're spending more time playing them than they are watching rented videos. So who are these people? Are they kids? Everybody 30 and under you can think of as part of the gaming world. And those are the people you're trying to sell newspapers to. Those are the people you're trying to reach out to. And here, this is interesting, 19% of them are 50 or older. So they're not just teenagers, you know? They're adults to a great extent. So what we need to learn how to do is edit to the interactive impulse. And I'm about to show you some really interesting work in this regard. What this means is you always need to understand that they're reading you on a keyboard when they're reading you online. They're reading you on a device that they play. They're reading you on a device where they expect things to happen in response to them. People want to see, hear, and sample the news, but they also want to contribute, talk, write, respond. We had the community presentation yesterday. People talked about how many people were writing on the websites. Part of that impulse is coming out of the media that people are growing up with now. And so now we're all talking about share of mind. You know, time spent with non-editorial media is about as much as the time spent with editorial media. Maybe it's past it now.